You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to this podcast on perennial allergic rhinitis hosted by Med Learning Group. This three-part series is titled Bridging the Gap, Aligning Guidelines, Patient Preferences, and Clinical Practice in Perennial Allergic Rhinitis. This program is geared towards members of the multidisciplinary care team who manage allergies, including allergists, immunologists, advanced practice providers, and other clinicians in both academic and community settings. In this, our third episode, we'll be talking about treatment of PAR against the backdrop of shared decision-making and multidisciplinary care. My name is Chris, and I'll be the host of today's podcast. Joining me once again is Dr. Scott Feldman, who was also involved in our first podcast on evaluation and assessment. Once again, Dr. Feldman is an associate professor of clinical medicine and pulmonary allergy and critical care, and he is also the allergy and immunology clinical clinic director at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Dr. Feldman, thanks once again for joining us.
Thanks, Chris. Very happy to be joining you again today.
So in our first podcast, we talked about evaluation and assessment of patients with allergic rhinitis. In our second, we spoke with another faculty member about some of the treatments, both evolving and current. For this one, our third, I wanted to focus the discussion on shared decision-making and multidisciplinary care. But first, I wanted to ask kind of a fundamental question. Why even treat allergic rhinitis, particularly when symptoms may not be a huge burden on the patient?
I often, depending on the patient's healthcare literacy, discuss the unified airway hypothesis, certainly talking about it with fellows or residents that I'm teaching. But in general, with type 2 inflammation, there are lots of other conditions and issues that can come along with uncontrolled rhinitis. If we think of the unified airway hypothesis, where controlling the allergic rhinitis helps control of lots of other comorbid conditions from asthma, recurrent sinus infections, or other potential issues. I think most people listening to this have probably had the experience of someone's allergies flare, or they get a sinus infection, then it spreads to their lungs and their asthma starts flaring. And so I kind of think of that as a connection between the epithelial airways and inflammatory cytokines and so on, that just once things are start going, it can affect other conditions and other organs in ways we try to get under control. Some of my pulmonary colleagues, I even tell them about data that controlling rhinitis symptoms can help COPD. So I think we all kind of know that there's an airway connection there. But yeah, in general, treating allergic rhinitis will help with these other conditions. For managing allergic rhinitis, when we discuss avoidance measures, things like keeping your animal out of the bedroom or dust mite avoidance or careful caution with outdoor pollens, you know, if you're exposed to less allergen, your asthma will improve, your atopic dermatitis will improve if things are not getting in the skin. Hopefully that'll help you sleep better and get fewer infections. So people who are going on allergy shots, for example, getting that under control, or anything else that kind of blocks type 2 inflammation will affect all these conditions, hopefully. And then, of course, the infection. So sometimes the patients get to me, their complaint is recurrent sinus infections, and they might be thinking it's immune deficiency, but with probing questions, you kind of uncover that they feel like they get a sinus infection every spring and every fall. And I say, how are you outside the infection? They're like, oh, I'm miserable in spring and fall. It always ends up in a sinus infection. And I said, this might be a seasonal allergy trigger. You know, by the time we get them on medication and their allergies, allergic rhinitis is better. It's not having sinus infection. So it never really was an immune deficiency. It was just the type 2 inflammation and allergies that were not under control. So those kind of questions can help. And again, anything that kind of gets the allergic rhinitis under control really leads to better improvement in all the other comorbid conditions.
Okay, so it's partially about treating the rhinitis itself and then, but also kind of managing a greater constellation of type 2 inflammatory conditions when present. So to piggyback on this, there's been a good deal of research on targeted therapies such as biologics, which we talked about a little bit in our second podcast, that address multiple inflammatory conditions such as asthma, atopic dermatitis, eosinophilic esophagitis, just to name a couple. And evidence is emerging that some of these therapies may help by default with allergic rhinitis, which you kind of mentioned. So what's your experience with this, treating one condition and seeing simultaneous improvement in another?
Yeah, I think we all kind of know that all this inflammation is kind of driven by the same pathways. So these are chronic inflammatory diseases, with allergic rhinitis is a part of it. Asthma, chronic sinusitis with nasal polyps, some people COPD, atopic dermatitis, even eosinophilic esophagitis is from some of this inflammatory pathway, and there's biologics that are FDA approved to treat that. You know, despite their coexistence and the underlying pathophysiology being the same, sometimes they're managed independently. Some people, they see GI and pulmonary and allergy when sometimes only one is needed. But when they're all kind of managed independently, this can lead to worse disease control, persistent symptoms, and poor quality of life if they're not really getting under control. So really therapies that target type 2 inflammation and the type 2 inflammatory cytokines, which include, you know, the IgE pathway, of course, and eosinophil pathway, IL-4, 5, 13, some of the more inflammatory IL-31 and TSLP. Targeting those pathways can help a lot of these other comorbid conditions. And I've seen plenty of people have improvement in their nasal symptoms and rhinitis with that as well. There are multiple examples from dupilumab, mepolizumab, omalizumab, and lots of other mAbs that can be involved in treating and blocking these pathways. There's an alphabet soup of clinical trials that have showed efficacy across a lot of these type 2 inflammatory conditions. You know, Innovate trial, Venture trial, Advocate trial, and so on. And many of these agents do have multiple indications for multiple inflammatory disorders to make an impact there. There are also some future biologic options that have ongoing studies in perennial allergic rhinitis that might be approved and able to use for rhinitis in the future. These include lebrikizumab, dupilumab, and omalizumab. Some of these are to block some of these pathways. People are looking at how much efficacy they're going to have for perennial allergic rhinitis. You know, I often have conversations with patients who are very anti-giving up their animal, or they really just cannot come to clinic regularly for allergy shots. Maybe a biologic is the better option for them, because something they can do at home and more convenient with their work schedule. So these options, I think, are very helpful for a certain subset of people, depending on the situation.
So there's then a lot of decisions to be made together with patients, you know, what therapy to use, the duration and severity of symptoms, managing pets, as you mentioned, inside and outside. Like I have a daughter who has seasonal allergies mostly, and she can't go anywhere near falling leaves because of the mold and stuff that's in it. So there's a lot of back and forth and individualization of care for patients. Over the past several years, there's been a big push for shared decision-making with patients. So what is shared decision-making and how does it work?
Yeah, I think I think of shared decision-making as a non-dictator approach. In other words, I'm not telling them what they must do, but kind of getting their input. So there's certain models. So the main one is a fun acronym, the SHARE approach. So really starting seeking your patient's participation and get them involved and explaining that they have as much input in what to do as I do, rather than the doctor telling them what to do. You know, they have to kind of participate and they're the one who has to ultimately do whatever we decide together. So once they're involved, then H is help. So we're really helping them explore and compare the treatment options. And there's, you know, advantages, disadvantages, both time and side effects and so on. So kind of walking through all the different options. And then A for assessing the patient's values and preferences and kind of hearing what they think about the different options that you explain to them. Eventually, you're going to R, reach a decision with the patient of something to try. And then E, evaluate the patient's decision. So, you know, I often tell people, like, your allergies are going to change each season depending on the situation. And we got to kind of check on you in good and bad times of year and make sure that we're making progress with any of these modifications and things that we're going to do. So altogether, I think the shared decision making is very helpful. And, you know, I often tell people none of these solutions are permanent. So we have time to evaluate and kind of see what is working for you or not. Some patients think they can do shots. And after a few weeks, they're like, this is really just not working for me. We got to explore something else. So we often do a lot of disclosure up front of the various options and let people kind of weigh in and see how where they want to start. Because it's often not one final answer right away. Rarely does that happen.
Let's give a quick example to that. So what do you do when, say, a patient tells you he or she doesn't like the smell or taste of a medication, or maybe experiences nasal dryness or bleeding with an intranasal agent? How do you approach a conversation within this context?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think most people listening have had experience of patients say, well, nose sprays don't work for me, or I don't like nose sprays. And it's really the probing that has to happen of what do you mean by that, or what don't you like about it, or why did it not work? And so, you know, the variety of answers people give, you know, I've had people say, oh, I tried it once and it didn't work. I'm like, yeah, you need it more than one time. Some people had a horrible, horrible technique. So we're often exploring the technique that they did. Some of the people who really hate the flavor, the taste, I often say, you know, there's more than one of these on the market, so we could try a different one. And sometimes they don't realize that. I've had patients complain they don't like the jet of liquid that, you know, they say, I feel like I was waterboarded. I said, no, we're going to find a different device for you. You know, maybe more of a mist and less of a spray. And then, yeah, someone with horrible dryness, sometimes we're discussing hydration or saline rinses to counteract some of this. Some people really just, despite all that, they can't do it. And then we're often discussing with the shared decision-making approach, maybe you really want to think about allergy shots, because if you're just not able to do nose sprays and manage this on your own, you may have to reconsider your work schedule and how much we can have you get here for allergy shots. Some people, again, if it's more of an animal thing or something where they can implement better avoidance measures, that lack of ability to tolerate any nose spray might push them to make more pet changes at home. I think this is really where the some of the tools we talked about in the other podcast, the RCAT and so on, can really help assess their control and kind of get them to realize that whatever intervention you've tried is either working or not working, and a reason to kind of try to get around some of the issues they might have with certain individual nose sprays, to try something else and then kind of quantify that their RCAT hopefully has improved, or move on to another treatment pathway.
So you alluded to adherence just now. If a patient doesn't like something or feels it's not working, even after a single dosage or a short time on it, like you mentioned, they're much more likely to stop it on their own. So how often do you assess medication adherence and discuss it with the patient?
Yeah, I think generally every visit. I mean, that's just a large part of what we do. I often say to people like, oh, are you using your nose spray? Like, yeah, I'm using it. I'm like, oh, how often do you use it? Or how often do you forget? Like, oh yeah, like I only do it a couple times a week. I only do it on days that I go to work in person because I forget to do it when I'm at home. A lot of patients forget that you know, for something like fluticasone, we're usually recommending 2 sprays per nostril in adults. They're like, oh, I've just been doing 1 and this spring hasn't been great. I'm like, well, I told you to do 2. You might want to go up. And then, you know, generally just kind of ask about side effects. If someone's having no side effects and feels good, I usually assume their technique is correct. But they're like, yeah, you know, I'm getting nosebleeds here and there. Or my nose has been a lot more dry this winter. Then you kind of go over technique again and make sure that's working well. You know, I often have to really reinforce with people that the mechanism behind something like a nasal steroid spray is more effective if used consistently. So I'm often providing strategies like maybe put it by your toothbrush. Hopefully you're brushing your teeth at least once a day. And that'll kind of help remind you to use the medication. And the younger people, I often say, you know, they're on their phone half the visit anyway. I say, why don't you open your phone right now and put an alarm in your phone that'll beep for you every day or remind you to do it until it becomes a habit. So we go over those kind of strategies. But really, it's every visit making sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, especially if they're not doing well or their patient questionnaires are showing they're not doing well. That's a very helpful step.
So we have guidelines and we have a variety of treatments available and a ton of research on how they work. I wanted to talk a little bit about the real world, which can sometimes be different than what you see in clinical trials, which have specific criteria for involvement and things like that. For example, how are patients actually managing their symptoms and how effective is this kind of on their own? I mean, are they successful when they take it upon themselves, or do you find people coming in the door who have tried several things but their symptoms persist and then you have to step in and fix it for them?
Yeah, for sure. I think most people will disclose to me that they're bad at using medications. You know, I often have people, they just flat out say, I'm not a medicine person, which didn't know that was possible, but they tell me that. So, yeah, I mean, again, people who are anti-medicine, sometimes I can kind of convince them to do a nose spray more than a pill. I say, look, you know, 98% of it is staying in the lining of your nose. Let's start there and kind of see how that goes. Some people are very like, I'm just not going to remember to do this every day. And then we talk about those strategies. But people are often free to admit that they're bad to adhere to the medications. I often, you know, also people who are bad at adhering to avoidance measures, they're like, yeah, I try to keep my cat out, but it keeps coming to the bedroom. I say, okay. You know, there's not any expectation of how much people are going to follow what I say. But a lot of people will self-medicate. So someone who really doesn't want to do something every day, sometimes I might change strategy and kind of give them more of a trial of a nasal antihistamine spray, which can be a little bit more effective, more PRN use. So for someone with a more seasonal thing, you know, I'm very adamant, like, look, you're telling me that this is the third spring in a row that you're suffering here. Why don't you try to really do this consistently at this time of year so we can follow up? A lot of patients who are kind of on the fence of whether they need allergy shots, give them some tough love and say, in order to kind of really tell if you can control yourself and not have to come here for shots, you really have to do this every day and see if it's effective. Because if you can control yourself, that might spare you the need to come for consistent allergy shots if that works. But I can't tell you how much the nose spray is going to work if you don't do what I'm saying and do it correctly. But yeah, a lot of people will do on-demand treatments, and I certainly discourage Afrin or nasal decongestants that can become addictive and lead to issues. But in general, most people don't really follow what we're saying. So again, I usually write out the instructions, make sure the prescription kind of says what to do and go over. I'll even put use this nose spray February 15th to May 31st or something like that, just to kind of remind them on the days.
So just one or two final questions as we wrap up this series. Just real quickly about multidisciplinary care. Who else is involved in the treatment of allergic rhinitis beyond yourself? Whether as an individual disease state or as one disease in a group of comorbidities within a greater set of conditions.
Yeah, absolutely. Some patients, with electronic medical records, I can usually see who else they're seeing. But someone with severe asthma is often seeing a pulmonologist as well. Sometimes I get a lot of patients who are like smokers and have allergies, and there might be some COPD overlap or other things that they would benefit from a pulmonary doctor. Dermatologists can certainly be involved for more severe eczema, or some people have like more than one skin condition. Someone who has like a scalp issue and eczema as well. They're seeing dermatologists for other stuff, and we often have to have conversations with them, kind of who's managing what or some of the other comorbidities that come along with it. Primary care providers, of course, are involved, and sometimes APPs and some of these various specialties. A lot of, not a lot, but some of my patients who have very mild symptoms, they're kind of seeing me just to get a test. They really just want to know, like, what tree is affecting me in spring. And their symptoms on more of the mild spectrum that we talked about earlier, sometimes I say, look, try this, and if it's really working well, you can go back to your primary care provider. I don't need to keep seeing you. If we know what you're allergic to now and you have a strategy that's working for you and a medication regimen that's working for you and your technique is good and so on. So we try to be judicious on who still needs their allergist and so on. But really working with all these different specialists for these kind of general type 2 inflammatory conditions can be very helpful in keeping people well managed and under control.
All right. So as we wrap up this series, give us just a couple main take-home points that you have for our audience who manages this condition.
Yeah, absolutely. I think overall it's important to remember that, there are good patient outcome measures, things that are well validated and scores to assess the severity and make sure people are doing a good decision-making and the right therapies for people. So things we talked about, like the RQLQ or RCAT, those tools are out there to help assess the severity of someone's symptoms and the control of it. In general, the allergic rhinitis management protocols are fairly standardized from guidelines. These include nasal sprays, antihistamines, leukotriene antagonists, allergy shots, and avoidance measures. Kind of all together are the different tools. And with those tools, there's going to be some shared decision-making to incorporate into routine management. Because with so many tools out there, the patient's the one who has to implement them or come to clinic for shots or do their nose spray at home. So kind of going over the different options and seeing what is important to somebody and how they want to approach their treatment. And of course, following up, making sure that something is working or not, so that you can perhaps go in a different direction with the patient's shared decision making as a part of that. And finally, I think some of the emerging directions, so updates to immunotherapy and SLIT and various other targeted biologic therapies that can be used for these type 2 inflammation pathways. There are lots of new research undergoing for new novel drug formulations, things like cryotherapy or AAVITS. All those might potentially become more utilized, generally speaking, in the future. But yeah, I think there's lots that can be done for allergic rhinitis currently and in the future. And altogether, having good plans that the patient and the doctor have made shared decision-making on is very helpful.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Feldman. Great to have you on board for this podcast and one of our earlier ones as well. And I'm glad you could take the time to share some of your tips and tools to help manage these patients with rhinitis. And thanks to all of our listeners for joining. Hopefully you tuned into the first two podcasts in this series. And if you haven't, I invite you to give them a listen as well. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. In support of improving patient care, MedLearning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would also like to give a special thank you to our educational grant supporter, Lily, who provided an educational grant for this activity. Thank you very much and have a great day.